Welcome to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. Today I am chatting with Dr. Marshall S. Rich about forensic cyber psychology. Marshall has a doctorate in business administration and management information systems and services, as well as a PhD in forensic cyber psychology, identifying adversarial behavior patterns in cyber attacks, and currently works for the United States Institute of Peace and is a senior expert in cybersecurity. Welcome, Marshall. I'm so delighted to have you on board.
Happy to be here.
Marshall, before we start chatting about the work you do, I just want to find a bit more about you and what that pivot point was for you in terms of your interest in cyber psychology and what got you into cyber psychology in the first place.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to do so. I'm Dr. Marshall Rich, a cybersecurity expert. I do have over 30 years of experience in cyber defense, incident response, and risk management. I've had the honor of working both in the military and the civilian sectors with multiple combat deployments as a signal officer in the Army National Guard, in leading strategic cybersecurity initiatives as a senior expert at United States Institute of Peace. My journey into cyber psychology was a bit of a pivot from the pure technical side of cybersecurity. The turning point came during my military service when I realized that no matter how sophisticated our systems were, the human element, the psychology behind why people make these decisions and what they do in cyberspace is the weak link. It fascinated me on how adversaries manipulate behavior. They exploit cognitive biases or use deception to breach systems. This led me to pursue my PhD in forensic cyber psychology, where I could merge both these technical and the human side of the cyber defense. You're correct. Today, I focus on understanding the psychology behind the threats and using that knowledge to predict and prevent and respond to those cyber incidents more effectively.
You mentioned that you start your career in the military and have a doctorate in essentially a cybersecurity. How has your military career and academic learnings played into what you do now?
It really has. The military side has really defined me. My career and my academic journey have been deeply intertwined and have really helped shape the work that I do today. In the military, particularly during my deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, I was responsible for critical communications and cybersecurity for thousands of soldiers in a highly volatile environment. That experience taught me the importance of the robust and fail-proof systems, but also highlighted how human behavior, whether it's in the decision-making process, which could be under stress or influence of psychological manipulation, it does play a huge role in both the cybersecurity and our operational success. On the academic side, my doctoral research allowed me to take that understanding further. I was able to study how cyber adversaries exploit human vulnerabilities and how we can predict and counter those actions by understanding the psychological factors at play. Combining these two perspectives, the technical rigor of the military career and the behavioral insights from academia, has really been crucial in my current work, where I focus on cyber defense strategies. I try to integrate both the human and the technical factors. It's a comprehensive approach that's extremely important today, given all of our complexity of modern cyber threats.
It's really interesting that you both got a military career, which has given you kind of an element of discipline, but also the academic rigor that also requires quite a substantial amount of discipline. But it's kind of the theory and the practical, and it must be a really strong blend that makes you so unique in what you do.
Yeah, it really does. It helps me, especially on the creating the cybersecurity awareness and training for my staff, or even just helping other agencies. I develop and design these awareness tools to educate a broad range of audiences. So I'm able to work from, I call it from the boardroom down to the server room. I'm able to work in a military environment, a commercial environment, or even in private sector academia. But each of these that I develop, they're tailored to a specific need, whether it's in that general awareness or if, again, it's in that advanced training for, you know, high-level cybersecurity professionals. The goal that I always try to do is empower the individuals with the knowledge and tools to really try to mitigate risk such as a phishing attack, social engineering, or other forms of cyber deception. By understanding both the technical and the psychological aspects of these threats, you know, we can really create a dynamic program that is, adjustable on the fly, because we just can't create awareness and training programs and let them be static. The threats and the dynamics of the threat are changing constantly, right? So we have to have these feedback loops that are adjusting the training based upon that feedback. So what that does is it really comes down to cyber threat intelligence. So I work on building systems that gather and analyze this data. This is where really my PhD work kicks in. These programs are typically used by security teams to stay ahead of the potential attacks. So we're predicting by understanding these tactics and identifying the vulnerabilities, we can develop a very proactive defense strategy instead of being reactive. The digital forensics analysis piece, on the other hand, we focus on post-incident response, where we investigate and analyze the breach to determine how that occurred, who was responsible, and how can we prevent that in the future. Overall, these programs aim to create a very holistic approach to cybersecurity, incorporating awareness, intelligence, and response to predict both the individual and the organization from these threats.
That is amazing. You run these quite often, don't you? The training programs, or is it kind of quite sporadic amongst the other work that you do?
It is. I think organizations outside of United States Institute of Peace, other agencies are starting to see some of the work that we're doing there, especially on the law enforcement side. I've done quite a bit of work with the FBI, DHS, CISA, and I've also worked with the big security firms like Mandiant and CrowdStrike. So using that information and the connections that I have, I am able to develop very unique and tailored programs for the staff, and also things that where USIP wants me to engage in another sector. So recently, in the last couple of weeks, I just returned from an overseas deployment where we worked with a partner nation on developing and implementing and teaching a governance, risk, and compliance program. And what we did was we developed what made it unique for this class. They already had the basic understanding of GRC and they've had that multiple times. So what we did was on the first day, we basically did an assessment, measured where they were at. We had developed multiple scenarios to work from. And over the next 4 days, all we did was exercises that reinforced that previous training they had, identified strengths or weaknesses, and then we would adjust the training again. And we did that on a daily basis. It was probably one of the most self-satisfying courses that I've done in several years because, dealing with a partner nation, sometimes they're very reserved. What's your modus operandi? What are you coming here to do? Are you really here to help me? I think that was clearly demonstrated by the morning on day two. Everybody really opened up, and it was a two-way sharing going back and forth. The other thing that I'm working with my staff, so currently right now, USIP operates in about 26 different conflict zones around the world. Each of those conflict zones have their unique threats, especially on the cyber side. And so what I do is, again, I work with those particular staff groups to help them understand because I need to understand their threats because they're on the ground. They've got the first person reality of what is really going on. And so once I get that, I'll put a plan together, and then we'll reconnect. Typically it's over a Zoom. I have gone into the field on several occasions, especially if they can bring their staff together at one location, that face-to-face is always the best. If for security reasons, let's say we can't bring them all together, then we do it remotely. But again, that training is very, very specific for the area that they're operating in, the threats in that particular area, and also what their concerns are. Because their concerns may not be our concerns, you know, so we want to make sure that we're addressing their needs, because frankly, and I think my military background helps that, they're the one on the ground, you know, their safety is the most important thing.
You've recently presented the Regular Warfare Lessons Learned Since 9/11 conference on cyber psychological warfare and irregular conflicts around the global war on terror. What were your top line learnings from this?
So I'm actually doing that presentation tomorrow, which is the thing that, from an academic and a research standpoint, where it really helped me was, and what I truly enjoyed was, one, I was able to bring my military experience back into the play. I looked at four specific campaigns or operations that the global war on terrorism was part of, or those operations were part of the global war on terrorism. And I analyzed them from a cyber behavior of cyber psychology and a cyber behavioral sciences viewpoint. And what I did was I identified areas that within those operations where they did not really know that they were doing it, but they were applying cyber psychology. So I'm able to use the real world example and say, hey, this is cyber psychology. Okay, now if we could combine that, if we take that and we combine it with cyber behavioral sciences and how we can integrate that cyber psychological piece of it, this is particularly how we can do it. So I did an operation for Iraq, Afghanistan, the Philippines, and the Horn of Africa. And I could have easily have picked just one region and stayed there, but I wanted to show the diversity across different conflicts, because each of those conflicts have different expected outcomes and things that we were trying to do. It also gave me I'm a big fan out of all the different cyber behavioral sciences that came into play, you know. So it was fun. I spent a lot of time on it because I had to go back and research those campaigns, and then trying to find the nexus to link that to cyber psychology and the behavioral sciences. It was fascinating.
You've spoken a little bit about the work you do in terms of the training. Are you able to talk a bit more about the work you do for the U.S. Institute of Peace?
Yeah, certainly. At USIP, I'm the senior expert in cybersecurity. So I lead all the strategic initiatives aimed at countering cyber threats and enhancing the overall defense capability. Because we are a government agency, I can only operate in a pure defensive standpoint. So USIP operates at the intersection of peace building and security. So my role is to ensure that the digital assets that the staff use to conduct those activities, as well as the peacekeeping missions, are protected. And really the big, so we do not process any classified information or store it. So most of all the work we do is unclassified. Much of it is also sensitive. So, you know, we have to take that into consideration as well. I spend a lot of time on that. And it's because, like I was saying before, we're operating in 26 different locations. USIP does not have a domestic mission. So everything that we do is in support of overseas activities. The other thing that USIP does is we host events, almost well over 1,000 events a year. We have very high level events where this could be, like the Africa Summit that was held, that, you know, had several dignitaries from across, and prime ministers and presidents and VIPs from all around the world. So you have all these other security agencies that are coming to your, coming to our building, making sure that, you know, the principal that they're protecting is protected. So I find myself having to work with those different agencies and even foreign agencies. And that really is for me, it's fun, because I get to see, how others might be doing it. And if that's something that we can apply. The other thing I do as I do try to build a rapport, asking them to look at what we're doing. And if they see something that it maybe is a risk or a weakness, or maybe there's a better way of doing it. So yeah, it's very, very fun and very, has a lot of energy. So you have to be very passionate about the work at USIP and what we're doing.
Do you think that the work is evolving and has evolved and continues to evolve as the threat actors change their tactics and the technology, the digital technology improves, changes, adapts, and new technology is added into the mix?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You have to. So you can very easily fall into the rabbit hole. And you can stay in that rabbit hole and you know, now you have no visibility of what's going on outside of you. So, excuse me. So I purposely make sure that that doesn't happen with me because I know that it can happen. So knowing that that's a possible trigger from a psychology standpoint, I know what my triggers are. So I avoid those triggers. So what I have to do is, I have to really, what I have to do is I'm very connected to the executive office, congressional relations and others, because I want to know what's going on at the Institute and if, and apply that to my cyber threat intelligence. You know, so if I see an example of a prime minister coming in to visit, or maybe a local embassy there in Washington, D.C. wants to conduct, because USIP is a wonderful place for a medium place to come and speak, because we are kind of quasi-government. You know, it's not as formal a setting as the Department of State because of the protocols and such. So we can just kind of be that in-between ground. But, you know, those embassies or those visitors, you know, they want to get the word out. You know, they want to let them know, I'm going to the United States Institute of Peace and I'm going to talk. Well, their threats are now our threats. And I now have to take that into consideration. So, you know, I've seen a lot while I've been working at USIP. I've seen electromagnetic interference where they bring in jammers and, you know, just kill all the devices inside of a room. You know, I've seen where they will, a bad actor will see that one of our staff members is going to a conference to speak, where they put such a targeted message together or an email, from the presenter of, or the conference standpoint that looks so legitimate and it may be just one little character off, and our staff will start to engage. So they'll hand over credit card numbers, frequent flyer IDs, hotel, you know, frequent hotel guest numbers and stuff like that. It's amazing that the level that our adversaries will go to. These are very, very smart folks. I usually tell people it's not really a cliche. Is this really is the stupid ones that are easy to spot. It's the ones that are really, really smart that scare me, because they will spend the time. They're very calculating on when they will do that as well. So, yeah, we've got to be real careful.
Yeah, because that's really is what part of what forensic cyber psychology is, isn't it? Is just understanding the psychology behind the bad actors, and especially to say the intelligent ones who spend time understanding behavioral science, understanding the psychology of those they're trying to target. And that's, you've got to understand their psychology in order to understand how they're going to start targeting. So you almost have to constantly be one step ahead of bad actors.
You are spot on. Exactly.
So talking about forensic cyberpsychology, I'd love to chat about your PhD in forensic cyberpsychology and specifically what you were wanting to study and kind of that gap in knowledge that you found that you wanted to research into.
Yes, great question. I really appreciate that. My PhD in forensic cyberpsychology, I focused on studying how we can proactively counter cyber threats by understanding cognitive bias and decision-making vulnerabilities of cyber attackers. Specifically in my, because I wrote three papers, each paper supported the next to my culminating exegesis. So towards the end of the publications and, you know, publishing my work, the proactivity of the countering the threat, I was focusing more on the network behavior, and I was specifically looking at being able to predict behavior from certain internet service provider locations or geographic locations in the world. So the geographic was fairly easy. That wasn't too hard. I just had to have the data and run it through. The difficult piece at first for me was when I wanted to answer that research question, was how do I do that at the internet service provider level? So I wrote some algorithms, you know, that's where the computer science and the programming come into play. I augmented the data, categorized quite a few things, especially in the numerical sense. And then at the end of that process, I had a strong algorithm that was able to predict using longitudinal history data, the likelihood that that actor would conduct activities the next day. And I was able to do that. I predicted 45 days out. And of the 45 days, my algorithms and predictions were 70% correct. So my wife asked me, and she goes, well, that's not very good, is it? You know, that's a really low C. And I said, no, you're looking at it wrong. I said, what I've done is I've taken 70% of the traffic that's a threat that's coming in, and I can now take that and throw it to the side. I don't need it because I've already identified it, right? And now what I can do is just focus purely on the 30%. Why didn't the 30% come up in the algorithm? What was the reasoning is why? Are there similarities? Maybe it should have been in an identified ISP, but because of how the ISPs register, maybe that particular IP address or the source where they were coming from didn't fall out into that identified threat. So, yeah, so that's where you can really start to refine it and get it down closer and closer. And the idea is that I want to focus on what the biggest threat is. And the biggest threat is the 30% that I don't know about. And it's typically what you don't know about is what breaches you. So, yeah. So I thought that was the critical gap. It really did. I really did apply both cybersecurity and cyber behavioral sciences to that as well. It really allowed me to look at the drivers behind that because of part of the algorithm, I also utilized advanced persistent threats or APTs. I looked at were they criminal, were they just hacking gangs, were there script kiddies, or is it a nation state? So you know, and that's where once you identify that criminal behavior, the forensic side, now you can apply that with. Combine it with the psychological drivers. And when you combine those two, you have a very effective defensive strategy. So that's really what my research was trying to do.
You had one of your aims in your research was to, I'm going to read this because I can't remember exactly the words. So it's to proactively counter cyber threats by focusing on cyber attackers' cognitive biases and decision-making vulnerabilities. Is this where forensic cyberpsychology differs from cybersecurity or the psychology of cybersecurity? Because In my head, forensics is about the understanding the actor's behavior, and cybersecurity psychology, or the psychology of cybersecurity, is about the victims. Can you talk a bit more about that?
You're spot on. That was correct. So the cyber psychology is more on the victim side. It's looking at it holistically. On the forensic cyber psychology, we're adding the potential criminal aspect of that, right? So we have to follow, you know, evidentiary procedures, you know, and chains of custody and all the things that are going on with that. But what we're also doing is at the individual, or it could be an organizational level, like if it's a criminal gang or something like that. But yes, the forensic analysis, the digital forensics, that is what Dr. Aiken and I, we call that the technical dimensions. So there's the technical dimensions where forensics, digital forensics would be a technical piece of it. But the cyber behavioral sciences, that's where psychology is. So if you were to combine the two, you're taking the digital forensics process or any other technical piece of that, then you're applying the cyber behavioral sciences, which in this case would be cyber psychology, to be able to build a proactive stance to help stand forensic cyber psychology apart from the other, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
You're right. Forensic cyber psychology really zooms in on the attackers themselves.
You mentioned Dr. Aiken, and that's Dr. Mary Aiken. So she was one of your supervisors, wasn't she?
She was. Wonderful. I cannot speak enough about the assistance and the guidance that she gave me. I have a pretty strong background coming into it. I knew what I wanted to do. I thought I had a pretty good understanding of the cyber psychology side. And with my experience with law enforcement and even with the military, the forensic side I thought I had. But what I had not done was put the two together, and she told me some things to go study, go read these papers, do some more literature review, go back and look at your scientific method, look at some of your forensics procedures, and then let's come back and have another talk. And it was that reawakening. And really what it was it helped me connect what I knew. It was all jumbled up here, right? And it helped me put it into what, and she'll love this, is, you know, there's three important things through this whole process: structure, structure, and structure. So that's what happened. I was able to then put it into a structured format. It made complete sense to me. I was like, all right, everything I wrote so far, that's great, but we're going to push that to the side. And now we're going to go at it in this direction. So she was really good at keeping me aligned. I did the work. She helped me quite a bit sometimes on, especially at the beginning when I was doing that rewrite, creating that nexus, being very precise on the terms that were being used. And once I had that, again, I was off to the races. And she really wanted me to keep my last paper down to a little over 7,000 words, I think what it was, but there was just no way. None of my papers were even close to 7,000, but they were all well over that. But yeah, she's fascinating to listen to. Her ability to be able to memory recall just all the work that she has done over the years in the decades across so many different areas. It's just unbelievable the amount of detail she can pull out and just relate that to what you're talking about. You know, she's not trying to push her ideas. She wants to genuinely listen to the student, take that information about the student and apply her experiences to that to then help that student go forward.
You also include in your research the cyber forensics behavior analysis model. Can you tell me a bit more about that? So that sounds really fascinating.
Yeah. So what that was is, so when you come down at the higher of the, so you have the model at the top. The immediately coming off that are two branches. You have your technical side, and I'm going to call it the behavioral side, right? So the technical side is running through all the analytics, you know, the statistics. I'm running predictive analysis tools, you know, all kinds of things, right? So I'm doing all the statistical things we would do on the technical side. On the behavioral side, what I start to do is I come down, and what happens is I pull, using a system that I've developed, I pull down 150 threat information database. You know, they publish this information mostly on a daily basis, so it's extremely up to date. I pull that down, as well as I take other reports, you know, from CISA or the FBI, or anything that's been placed out on the open source by Mandiant or CrowdStrike or those types of organizations. I pull that data in as well. And what happens is, at the end of all that data is basically turned into digits, right? So it's binary 0-1. It's categorized so that I can itself also run statistics against it. So what happens is I now take from the technical side, for example, let's just use IP addresses to keep it simple. On the technical side, I'll kick out that IP address. And then what I'll do is run it against my threat database that I built. And what I'm going to do is now create a behavior, two scores. The first score, basically what happens is in the spreadsheet, you'll have the IP address. And then across all the columns are all the different threats that have been identified and categorized. So there's 200 different sources of threat information. So what it does is it takes that IP address and it goes through each one of those and does either a 0 or a 1. A 0 is no, there's no match. A 1 means there's a match. And at the very end, I do a very basic calculation. How many 1s are there? So that just gives me a raw base score. The power that comes into this now is I take those 200 feeds and I create a behavior list. And what I do is I basically look at every combination of these lists. So does threat one also appear in threat two? Completely two different threat feeds. Okay, then that gets a 1. If 1 does not appear in 2, then it gets a 0. So what happens now is I'm now able to see, and what really helps me is now I can come out with a behavioral score that tells me that if I can now, in that behavioral score, I can also now profile that particular IP address. I can also then go into the matches and look at what they're doing. You know, what are those actors conducting? And how are they doing it? And then using the APT reports and the case reports and all of that, I'm able to then dive into the motivations, the behaviors, and the whys. Are they doing this? So it's, and that comes out with a score as well. So I take that. So remember over in the technical side, I had the predictions. I take that, I pull that score over, merge that report, and I tell it to give me a top 20 list for the next 45 days, or the top 100, whatever I want to call it out as. And then I just sit back and I monitor, you know, how successful was that prediction. And, you know, like I said, I'm able to get up to about 70% right now.
So what I'm hearing in all of that is that, say there's Joe Bloggs, who is a threat. He's one of the baddies, and he is trying to get into some system. And you will be able to say, okay, Joe Bloggs, who's associated with that IP address, normally someone who does this kind of threat also does this kind of threat. And this is kind of the psychological behavior that's linked to those two things. Whereas Pete Jones is with another IP address and he does this other threat, but they're generally this type of person only does this kind of threat. And there's about a 70% chance of them doing this over the next 45 days. Does that kind of sum it up as a and the outcomes of that model.
You're spot on again.
Okay, wow. That's extraordinary, because that really does hone down to, if someone is doing this behavior and as the victim in whatever sphere that is in, you will then be able to say, well, this may also happen, so we need to look out for that. And you can kind of predict other behavior and make allowances for that and try and stop that behavior happening.
Yeah. So an example of that at USIP is, and I do this all the time, at least 2 to 3 times a week. So I'll run the same algorithms in our Office 365 environment, looking at failed logins and such. So I'm then able to analyze the threats against our internal staff. I'm able to now pull down, you know, quite a bit about that attacker. And then what I'll do is I will reach out to that individual individually, and I will say, hey, look, this activity is happening. I know that in the next week or so, you're publishing a paper, or you're hosting a conference, or you're attending a conference. You need to be on the lookout for this type of thing. And, I have a very, very good track record with those predictions. So that's an example.
Forewarned is forearmed, as they say. Yep. That's extraordinary and such valuable, valuable, vital work. So you also speak about a hackbot. And it was originally presented by Lundy et al. What is a hackbot and how is it useful?
So that was a paper that Dr. Aiken worked on as well. It was presented last year at the conference in Hawaii that they do on an annual basis. And the concept was that just as the hackers that are out there, the adversaries, they're deploying their cyber bots out there to conduct these activities from, you know, there's thousands of these things, and they're impossible to defeat. So the concept of the hackbot is basically taking that and reversing it back onto the adversary. So it's kind of a hack back. One of the themes for that paper was the enterprise strikes back. So, that's us using the hackbots that they're using to basically hack them back. So it was a theory, you know, it's not a practice. It's a concept, you know, here in the United States, I can't do that. For me, that's illegal. But doesn't prevent other agencies that do have that authority to be able to conduct that. So
it's defense by attack.
Yes.
That sounds quite aggressive, but it's kind of counter defense in some ways.
Well, you know, at some point, that's what it's going to take. You know, the bad folks out there that are doing this, they don't have much to lose. You know, if you think about it, it would be interesting to pull out the number of attacks that are criminal that occur each day. And you could even narrow it down to a state or an industry or something. And then how many of those criminal activities were prosecuted? The number is extremely low, you know? So there's no skin in the game on their side. So, okay, you take down my internet service provider. Okay, I'll just go get me another one. You know, I'll put my servers in Iran or in Russia or whatever. So I was part of an investigation where they were, these bad actors were buying product off Amazon and other sites like that, having the products, they were buying them with stolen credit cards. The products were being shipped to a U.S. address, where at that address they would forward it in a container or something like that to Nigeria. So when the FBI and the investigations were going on, what wound up happening at the very end of Summit Up was you had a criminal gang sitting in Nigeria that were using stolen U.S. credit cards to purchase product in the United States, have that shipped back, shipped to Nigeria. Now, all of this digital transactions and all the storage of this information, all their applications ran on servers sitting in Iran. So now what are we going to do? So who loses is the credit card companies. You know, the people that use those credit cards legitimately, and there was no consequence for the folks sitting in Nigeria or the people that are running the servers in Iran. There's none. Mm. So, yeah.
Because that comes down to jurisdiction, doesn't it? Of where the enforcement officers or law enforcement is able to actually do anything about it. You can kind of do something about the criminal gang in the US potentially, but not nowhere else in the world.
That's correct.
You also spoke about cybersecurity practitioners adopting a multi-dimensional strategy and looking at the technical measures as well as the cyber psychology insights. So you've kind of spoken about that a little bit, but I wonder if there's anything more you want to chat about that in terms of practically from a cybersecurity perspective. They need both the technical insights, but also understanding of the psychological issues.
So definitely I advocate for a multidimensional approach. I mean, you have to have that, and that's that technical and behavioral dimensions that I spoke about before. So this means that we're going to be combining those technical measures with the insights from cyber psychology, right? To understand not only the vulnerabilities in the system, but the human vulnerabilities that the attackers are exploiting. So I suggest that cybersecurity practitioners adopt a strategy like cognitive bias training, implementing some behavioral analysis models, using deception techniques that target specific psychology of the attacker. You know, ultimately, we're trying to integrate these insights so that we can create a more resilient defense, and hopefully it'll help us stay ahead of any other emerging cyber threats. One of the key things, though, with these strategies, the cognitive bias training, the implementing the behavioral analysis model, deception techniques, and so on, is that what's extremely important is the feedback loop. I call it the feedback loop. As I said, you know, this is emerging threats. They're changing their tactics, their techniques daily. And the threat information that we have on where they're sourcing from is changing on a daily basis. So we have to keep that continuous feedback feeding into those models so that we can refine that and make the best prediction for tomorrow, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a continuously learning field, if that makes sense. It's, you have to always know what's going on. You can't sit on your laurels in this field at all. And talking about that, what is your greatest concern around forensic cyber psychology for the future, both for professionals as well as the kind of generic digital technology user?
Yeah, for professionals, the challenge lies in keeping pace, especially with the rapidly evolving tactics of the cyber criminals. As technology advances, so do their methods. And they're now exploiting human behavior. You know, the example that I used with one of our staff members going to that conference, that attacker exploited her human behavior by, you know, presenting a very realistic representation of the legitimate person, right? So attackers are becoming more adept. They're manipulating those psychological vulnerabilities. They're using very sophisticated social engineering techniques. And, you know, today, now that we even have AI, which can now scale up their efforts to make it even harder to detect and defend against. This concern is the concern is that cybersecurity professionals may continue to focus too much on the technical defenses and not enough on the understanding the human element. If we don't invest in that interdisciplinary approach, combining cyber psychology with digital forensics, AI, and other fields, we risk falling way behind. The field must develop faster, more effective ways to anticipate and counter these behavioral tactics. There needs to be a greater emphasis on training and education, specifically in cyber psychology and in forensic cyber psychology.
It sounds as though we desperately need people in this field, because we're sort of under-resourced in cyber psychology, especially in forensics and cybersecurity. So if someone did want to get into the field of forensic cyber psychology, what is the best route for them to take?
So this could take a minute. For anyone thinking about entering the field, specifically forensic cyber psychology, it does involve a combination of education, practical experience, and interdisciplinary learning. It's a highly specialized field. You're blending cybersecurity, psychology, digital forensics, and then also just all the other technical hardware and software that's out there, firewalls, web filters, gateways, understanding IP addressing, and so on. All of this is going to help build that strong foundation in the areas. So if I had to do a roadmap, what I would start out with is the education. So start pursuing a degree, either in psychology or cybersecurity, depending on your primary interest. Forensic psychology, criminology, criminal science could also be additional focuses. And again, we're staying on the technical side with that, right? So many universities are now starting to offer programs like cyber psychology. I would not say it's an emerging field anymore, cyber psychology, but I would say that forensic cyber psychology is. And it's using those universities, you're able to get a very targeted education. So after you get your education, you need to look at very specialized training, especially if you don't have any law enforcement background. You need to make sure that you understand those certifications. So you're going to cover areas in the specialized training. You should look at digital forensics, cyber threat intelligence, social engineering. There are, especially if you're just starting out, there are certifications out there that will help quantify what you've done. So you pass those, there's a certain level of knowledge that you've demonstrated. So certified ethical hacker, the certified information system security professional, or any other specialized training in forensic analysis are going to be very valuable. Make sure that you're understanding the psychological aspects of the cybercrime. So make sure you're going back and looking at that digital forensics, forensic psychology, and understanding how those cyber criminals are going to work. If you're able to get into the psychological aspects or take some additional courses, I would look at psychological aspects of cybercrime, such as manipulation tactics, cognitive biases, behavioral analysis. Those will really help set you apart. So once you've got that education and that specialized training, now you're starting to bring it all together. So the forensic cyber psychology is sitting at that crossroad when you're bringing it together. And having that interdisciplinary mindset is very, very key. So take courses or attend workshops that help merge psychology with cybersecurity. You definitely have to stay up to date on the research. It is changing very fast. The papers that I published, they're good in helping you get some in-depth knowledge on both sides of the field, especially my last paper. So now that you've merged these things together, now you want to go get some hands-on experience, right? So you need to go gain some practical experience. This is crucial. If you're just getting into the field, look for internships, look for entry-level positions. And those positions could be in cybersecurity, digital forensics, behavioral analysis, many organizations now are creating an insider threat behavioral analysis unit. So that might be something that you could get started with at the very bottom as maybe an analyst. Maybe you're just collecting information. And then hopefully over time, you're able to then see all the processes you go through to work with that data. If you're working in the cybersecurity side, I would focus on skills in analyzing cyber threats and cyber attacks, and then try to approach that from a behavioral perspective, what you learned with your psychology. And then the next thing after you get all that, after you've gotten your hands on, is get out there and network, right? Start mentoring other people that are just getting started. One of my favorite sayings is, you can learn by teaching, especially when you're a subject matter expert, you're getting up there talking, as you're engaging with students or whatever, you're actually learning as you go, because they're hopefully that class is energetic. They're very, very engaging. So they're asking the questions why, and then you know, that's engaging your brain, hopefully in a way that you're learning as well. I see a big demand for forensic cyber psychology. I think the demand is going to be both on the technical and the human factor side. I prefer to stay on the human factor side, but like I said, I can operate in the boardroom or the server room, so I can work on both sides of the fence. So you bring all that together, and I think you're going to be a hot commodity. You know, you'll have rounded out the interdisciplinary approaches that are required to be able to operate as a psychologist, a forensic cyber psychologist.
It sounds as though demand is going to outstrip supply pretty quickly. And it's to get into the field means that you will be in quite a lot of demand, but a lot of work to get there, but a lot of demand for that specialty.
It's going to be fascinating. I can't wait to see some of the, you know, we've got some forensic cyber psychology PhD students now. They're just getting started. So hopefully within the next 4 to 6 years or so, we'll start to see, you know, the impacts of their contribution. I see now that in some of the bigger conferences, they're starting to add cyber psychology components, especially with the conference that's in Hawaii in January. That one actually has a mini track on cyber deception and cyber psychology together. So that's the kind of work that we need. We need folks to present to those conferences, or at least share papers and research that they're doing.
That would be a good conference for those interested in forensic cyber psychology to go to start doing some networking, wouldn't it?
I think it would be.
Yeah.
Expensive ride to get there.
But it is. But definitely worth it from a networking perspective.
Exactly.
We're coming to the end of the podcast in questions, and I normally have three questions at the end that I ask all my guests. And the first of those questions is, Marshall, what is the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
Great question. I think the most important question is how we can better integrate human behavior into the future of cybersecurity defenses. We talked a lot about cyber psychology and the technical aspects. The real future of the field lies in blending these two. As the threats evolve, we need to shift our mindset from viewing cybersecurity purely as a technical challenge to recognizing that it is a human one. Attackers will and always will exploit the psychological vulnerabilities of our users. We have got to integrate these behavioral insights into our defensive strategies if we're going to, because right now we're playing catch up, right? And I call it whack-a-mole, you know? And we're just trying to whack the mole that pops its head up. We're not able to get ahead of it. So I think that is really, we've got to put ourselves in a position where we are ahead of it. And I think the strength of forensic cyber psychology, especially on predicting, is extremely important for us to be able to get there.
And as you say, the psychology behind why people do things, and also the psychology of the victims, so we can build better resilience and understand defense mechanisms in order to not become a victim.
I also think by combining artificial intelligence with cyber psychology and creating defenses, that this is going to be a very potent tool in our arsenal. And hopefully, with the use of AI, we can start to outthink our adversaries and get ahead. Now, to counter that on their side is they're going to be doing the same thing. They're going to be using AI to conduct those activities. So,
second question that I normally ask is, there's often frustration among cyber psychologists that journalists sometimes take snippets of academic findings and kind of use them and sensationalize them to foster clickbait articles and creates moral panic and push negative social narratives around digital technology. Do you think the media is getting better or worse at accurately presenting or representing journalist academic findings?
Well, I think with our field in cyber psychology, I don't think there's enough media attention, really. I think that once media gets a hold of cyber psychology and how that particularly plays out, I think actually my paper that I'm presenting tomorrow, and I'll be glad to share it on LinkedIn, is really kind of a step on how cyber psychology is able to counter misinformation or social engineering or disinformation. So, yeah, I think ultimately, you know, we know that the media outlets today, they tend to prioritize their attention on what's grabbing the headline instead of really over detailed factual reporting. So they do tend to misrepresent, especially something as complex as cyber psychology. And then you throw forensic cyber psychology on it, it's really going to cause them to have some problems. So I think they're going to have to start investing themselves in learning what the field is and how it can be applied in a media environment. Because ultimately, what we really want them to do is give out factual information as fast as possible so that we can, you know, let users or the people out in the world know that this is coming at them. And if we can get ahead of it, we can defeat it. You know, if we can't get ahead of it, we're playing reactions. And, you know, we see things like the Nigeria issues that I spoke of earlier.
So it's the media using psychological, cyber psychology insights in order to educate the general public so that they have greater defenses against attacks and being less likely to become victims. And that's what we really need.
Yeah. So if you could also take this same question and just remove the word media and replace it with a military adversary, and it's basically the same processes. So I think from a high level, we could probably create us a process that would help media to be able to explain this very complex idea. Because what we don't want to do is the media get a hold of it in pieces. They think they have answered it, or they're trying to get that out quickly. And as a result, they generate moral panic or fear. And we then have bigger problems. So we don't want that. So
that's a very good point. Final question, Marshall, is if you've got a cyber psychology book that you would recommend or normally recommend to people to read, what would that be?
That's easy. I have to go with Dr. Aiken's The Cyber Effect. She does, I mean, right from chapter one, sitting in a police station in Los Angeles, you know, she's on the bench sitting there waiting. And that's the on the ground experience, that real life experience that she's had, that she's able to take that and apply it into what is cyber psychology. And if you've seen the cover of her book, it actually is a rabbit looking down a hole. And, you know, she's trying to avoid that. So, I mean, she does a fascinating exploration of how the digital world influences human behavior. She does it at the really almost starting when children in their early development can start to understand, and, you know, their brains are developing all the way up to where you're fully grown and you've had life experiences. So she can apply that all the way through that time scale. She looks at everything from cybercrime to online anonymity. And what I really love is how children are impacted by this technology. It focuses on, it doesn't necessarily focus in on negative aspects. It does provide insight in how we can better manage the relationship with technology and do it in a healthy and constructive way. Yeah, fascinating book. I've read it probably half a dozen times. And I've also have the audio book, and I listen to that when I go on long drives too. So I learn something every time I read it.
Absolutely. That is the first book I ever read in cyber psychology. And I have to blame her for getting me into this field completely, because it hooked me from page one, and I consumed it at speed. It was just so fascinating. So
There is a second book. So if you're looking at it from a military perspective, there's a book called Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. And it's by Singer and Friedman. And what they do is they focus on the intersection of cybersecurity in the nexus with global conflict. So it touches on human elements involved in all these cyber threats and defensive strategies. But if you look, if when you're reading that book and you, as you're now you need to know what cyber psychology is and probably read Dr. Aiken's book first. But once you start into that book, just keep that reference in mind, that cyber psychology as you're going through there. And it really does help paint a picture on the futures of cyber warfare.
Marshall, thank you so much for joining me on Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It's been such a delightful conversation. I've learned so much through our chat together. And I hope we get to chat again soon about the work you're doing and what you're going to be doing going forward.
No, I appreciate what you're doing. And this is how we get the word out, right?
Absolutely.
Thank you.